Today is Tuesday, August 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The decision in the 2005 Beirut bombing that killed Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri is out.
Finds Salim Jamil Ayash guilty as a co-perpetrator of count one.
Plus, will Belarus see another election soon?
Belarus's president, Alexander Lukashenko, told tractor workers in Minsk that he's ready to share power, but said there wouldn't be another vote until he was killed.
And a recap of night one of the Democratic Party's virtual convention in the U.S. We'll have those stories and more next. 15 years ago, Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri was killed in a blast that also claimed the lives of 21 others. The United Nations-backed tribunal into that assassination released its decision Tuesday.
The trial chamber, therefore, finds Salim Jamil Ayash guilty as a co-perpetrator of count one, conspiracy aimed at committing a terrorist act.
For more, I spoke with George Eade in Beirut.
Well, the UN-backed Special Tribunal for Lebanon Tuesday found the main defendant guilty on all accounts for his involvement in the 2005 assassination of former Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri and acquitted the three others. It found Hezbollah member Salim Jamil Ayash guilty of being a co-perpetrator in the conspiracy to commit a terrorist act, of committing a terrorist act of intentional homicide of Prime Minister of Lebanon Hariri and 21 others, and of the attempted intentional homicide of the 226 others who were injured by the massive truck bomb that rocked Beirut on February 14, 2005. The trial chamber was satisfied beyond reasonable doubt Ayash possessed one of the six mobiles used by the assassination team. Judge Micheline Brady, when reading a summary of the 2,600-page verdict, said that the evidence showed that Ayash had affiliation with Hezbollah. Also, Hassan Habib Mirai, Hussein Hassan Onaisi, and Assad Hassan Sabra are also known Hezbollah members, but all were acquitted of the charges alleging their involvement in the plot due to insufficient evidence. The trial chamber said there was no evidence that either Hezbollah's leadership or the Syrian regime had any involvement in the assassination that took place 15 years ago. The case was based almost entirely on evidence gathered from mobile phone records, with the prosecution having examined millions of calls and text messages from the time leading up to the event.
So what's been the reaction around Beirut and around Lebanon to this announcement?
The street is divided between those who are disappointed with the International Tribunal's verdict and those who have accepted it and do not want strife in the country. The Lebanese security forces had anticipated the verdict by taking the necessary measures to deal with any tensions that might appear. We also have a comment from former Prime Minister Saad Rafiq Hariri's son and political heir. While he was attending the session, Hariri stated after the verdict, "The International Tribunal issued the verdict and it is our duty as Lebanese to accept its decision. And this does not mean that matters are over, for there are other issues." Hariri continued, "The importance of today's historical moment lies in the message to those who planned and committed the terrorist act. The time for letting political crime slide without punishment and without a price is over, and the price will inevitably be paid." He also demanded that the truth and justice for Hariri and his companions be known, may justice be achieved for all the innocent people who were killed in Beirut port explosion, including all the injured and their family, and everyone whose homes and businesses were destroyed as well.
Reporter George Eade in Beirut, Lebanon. Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko was not warmly received on Monday when he visited a factory in Minsk to try and rally support. After more than a week of protests urging the longtime leader to step down, Lukashenko said he'd never cave into pressure. Reuters reporter Joe Davies takes things from here.
After days of mass protests, Belarus's president Alexander Lukashenko now says a new presidential election will be held after the country adopts a new constitution. That's according to Russian media. It came only hours after he told tractor workers in Minsk that he's ready to share power, but said there wouldn't be another vote until he was killed. Lukashenko is facing the biggest challenge of his 26 years in power. The country has been beset by protests and strikes since he won a sixth term in office on August the 9th, in an election which his opponents say he rigged. Eyes are now on Russia, Belarus's ally going back to the Soviet era, where President Putin has offered Lukashenko military help. Lithuania's foreign affairs minister reacted by saying Russian military help in Belarus would constitute an invasion. That intervention came as Belarus began carrying out military exercises near the border with Lithuania. But a senior parliamentary official in Lithuania said the exercise didn't pose a threat and Lithuania would not be reacting. Lithuania is also where Belarus opposition politician Svetlana Tikhanovskaya fled last week to be with her children. On Monday, she released a new video demanding a new election and said she was ready to lead her country.
I'm prepared to take responsibility and act as the nation's leader during this period so the country settles down and gets back to normality. So that we can release all political prisoners and prepare a legal framework and conditions to hold another round of presidential elections in the shortest time possible.
The EU has also waded in, launching a process of imposing sanctions on Belarusian officials it deemed responsible for election fraud and a crackdown on protests that followed the disputed election result.
That was Reuters' Joe Davies. Igor Leschenya, the Belarusian ambassador to Slovakia, who supported protesters rallying against the election results, has handed in his resignation. He expressed solidarity with those who came out on the streets of Belarusian cities. That was posted in a video statement Saturday. Leschenya was the first top government official to support the protests against Alexander Lukashenko. South Korea will ban large public gatherings and shut down churches and night spots in the capital of Seoul and the surrounding area following a surge in viral infections that the health officials there describe as the country's biggest crisis since the emergence of COVID-19. In a nationally televised announcement on Tuesday, Prime Minister Chung Se-kyung said strengthening social distancing restrictions for the Seoul metropolitan area was inevitable, because failing to slow the transmission in the region could result in a major outbreak nationwide. The area is home to half of the country's 51 million people. In Gyeonggi Province, which surrounds the capital, masks have also been mandated indoors and outdoors to help curb the spread of the novel coronavirus. South Korea reported 246 new cases Tuesday, mostly from the capital area, pushing its total for the past 5 days to 959. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern hit back on Tuesday against U.S. President Donald Trump for saying her country is experiencing a big surge in COVID-19. Reuters' Libby Hogan has that part of the story.
New Zealand's leader Jacinda Ardern.
Obviously, I don't think there's any comparison between New Zealand's current cluster and the tens of thousands of cases that are being seen daily in the United States.
Trump's comments have started an uproar in New Zealand. Just 13 new infections were confirmed in New Zealand on Tuesday, taking the tally of infections to nearly 1,300 since the pandemic began, whereas the United States have recorded more than 5 million cases. After brushing off any parallel between the two countries, Ardern added that she doubted people would be fooled by Trump's comments.
Look, I think for anyone who's following COVID and its transmission globally, will quite easily see that New Zealand's 9 cases in a day does not compare to the United States' tens of thousands, and in fact does not compare to most countries in the world. I'm not concerned about people misinterpreting our status.
New Zealand has fared far better than most countries during the pandemic, but an abrupt resurgence of COVID-19 last week in its biggest city, Auckland, prompted the government to extend a lockdown.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. Federal officials in Australia will be facing a parliamentary committee Tuesday over a cruise ship scandal that fueled the country's coronavirus crisis. More than 2,500 passengers were allowed to leave the cruise ship Ruby Princess without being tested after it docked in Sydney in March, despite suspected COVID-19 cases on board. Phil Mercer has the details.
The Ruby Princess was the source of one of Australia's biggest coronavirus clusters. It led to 28 deaths and more than 1,000 infections across the country and overseas. Senior officials from Australia's Border Force and Agriculture Department, which had staff on board the cruise liner, are expected to face tough questions from lawmakers in Canberra. They're investigating how and why 2,650 passengers weren't tested for the virus despite suspected cases on board. After completing an 11-day cruise to New Zealand, travellers were allowed to disembark at Sydney Harbour and catch public transport and domestic and overseas flights home. A parliamentary committee was set up in April to examine the government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. It's due to complete its final report in June 2022. A separate New South Wales inquiry into the Ruby Princess has blamed state health authorities for inexcusable mistakes. They had declared the ship to be low risk, but the inquiry found they should have tested sick patients immediately. A police investigation into the scandal continues. New South Wales State Premier Gladys Berejiklian says monumental mistakes were made.
Can I now apologise unreservedly to anybody who suffered as a result of the mistakes that were outlined in the report undertaken by individuals within the health department? Not only have lessons been learned, but clearly those circumstances should and will never happen again in New South Wales.
Following the Ruby Princess debacle, about a dozen other cruise liners were banned from docking at Australian ports due to the risk of spreading the coronavirus. Australia has had about 23,500 confirmed coronavirus cases. More than 420 people have died. The centre of the public health crisis is the state of Victoria. It recorded 222 new cases Tuesday and 17 deaths. State Premier Daniel Andrews has previously described COVID-19 as a cunning and wicked enemy. For VOA News, Phil Mercer, Sydney.
VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website and still to come.
Delegates at the convention crafted a document that called for equality with men, including the right to vote.
This is VOA News.
In a minute.
Popular science fiction movies like Interstellar or the classic 2001 A Space Odyssey portrays astronauts on incredibly long-distance missions, hibernating or being placed in suspended animation for most of their journeys. Two new and separate studies that address placing mice, a species that doesn't naturally hibernate, into a hibernation-like state suggest that science fiction may someday become science fact. One of the studies came from researchers at the Harvard Medical School and the other from Japan's University of Tsukuba and the Riken Center for Biosystems Dynamics Research. Each study details the identification of neurons in the brain that, when stimulated, put their mouse test subjects into a hibernation-like state for several days. When animals such as bears, snakes, or bees hibernate, their heart rate and breathing slows and their body temperature drops. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Democrats appealed for party unity Monday as they reached out to voters across the United States in the first night of a virtual convention that will set their nominee for the November general election. Former Vice President Joe Biden and running mate Kamala Harris, a senator from California, will get the party's nomination later this week. As VOA's Michael Sullivan reports, the televised event is intended to generate excitement as the election campaign enters its final phase.
We can't let up.
An unprecedented event for extraordinary times, a social media gathering and television gala hosted by Hollywood star Eva Longoria Bastón. There were reminders of the racial tensions that have divided the nation, from the mayor of Washington, D.C., among others.
It was here that just weeks ago, Americans donned face masks and safely and peacefully protested the death of George Floyd.
There were the usual trappings of a convention, but the audience was remote, and most testimonials were pre-recorded, including one from former First Lady Michelle Obama.
I know Joe. He is a profoundly decent man, guided by faith. He was a terrific vice president. He knows what it takes to rescue an economy, beat back a pandemic, and lead our country.
crucial for Democrats who hope to oust the incumbent, support from progressives who rallied in the campaign around Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
We're facing the worst public health crisis in 100 years and the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression. We are confronting systemic racism and the enormous threat to our planet of climate change. And in the midst of all of this, we have a president who is not only incapable of addressing these crises, but is leading us down the path of authoritarianism.
Also important, support from moderate Republicans and independent voters. Former Ohio Governor John Kasich is backing Biden.
I'm a lifelong Republican, but that attachment holds second place to my responsibility to my country. That's why I've chosen to appear at this convention.
Less than 3 months before the election, the challenge for both parties, creating excitement for the candidates during a pandemic. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This evening, speakers at the convention will include New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, former President Bill Clinton, and former Second Lady Jill Biden. U.S. President Donald Trump is stepping up his attack against Joe Biden. As the Democratic convention got underway, an AP Washington correspondent, Sagar Magani, has more.
First in Minnesota.
Joe Biden is the puppet of left-wing extremists.
And then Wisconsin, which was to host the convention.
Biden is just a Trojan horse for socialism.
The president aggressively counter-programming Biden's big virtual show, even knocking that part of it, calling the convention's taped speeches a snooze. The locations were telling, the president visiting Midwestern battlegrounds as polls show him trailing Biden fewer than 3 months before the election. That kicked off his busiest week of campaign travel since before the pandemic. He'll be in Arizona today. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Gunfire was heard Tuesday at an army base outside Mali's capital of Bamako as the Norwegian embassy and a security force source. Gunfire was heard Tuesday at an army base outside of Mali's capital of Bamako, as the Norwegian embassy and a security source said a possible military mutiny was underway. Local residents and security sources said there was gunfire at the army base in Kati, about 15 kilometers outside Bamako, where a mutiny in 2012 led to a coup d'etat, although it was not immediately clear who was firing at whom. A military spokesman has confirmed that gunshots were fired at the base in Kati, but said that they did not have any further information. Opponents of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita have led mass protests since June, calling on him to resign over what they say are his failures to restore security and address corruption. Several mortar shells have hit various parts of Kabul, wounding 10 people, including 4 children, as Afghans were marking their country's Independence Day. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack on Tuesday morning. The Interior Ministry's spokesman says the mortars were fired from 2 vehicles in the northern and eastern part of the Afghan capital. The attack came a day after the government said it would not release the last of 320 Taliban prisoners it holds until the insurgents free more captured Afghan soldiers. The decision is likely to further delay the start of intra-Afghan peace talks sought by the United States. It was 100 years ago today that U.S. women were granted the right to vote through the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The amendment was introduced to Congress in 1878 and took more than 40 years to be passed and ratified by 3/4 of the states. VOA's Deborah Block looks into the history of the women's suffrage movement and women's equality today.
Feminists in the late 19th and early 20th centuries championed women's suffrage in the United States during a long and difficult struggle. The fight for suffrage began in 1848 at the first Women's Rights Convention held in a church in Seneca Falls, New York. Delegates at the convention crafted a document that called for equality with men, including the right to vote. As women fought for suffrage for more than 70 years, black women were not welcomed into the movement by whites. As the roles of women were changing in the early 20th century, a new generation of women continued the struggle. They stepped up their protests, organizing parades, silent vigils, and hunger strikes. After President Woodrow Wilson changed his stance to support the amendment in 1918, it was ratified 2 years later. A century later, however, many women face voter suppression, especially those who are black. Inequalities like these may be resolved through the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, proponents say, which was first introduced by suffragists in 1923. The future of the ERA is uncertain, but like the women who fought to vote, advocates say they will keep fighting for it. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
And finally, U.S. President Donald Trump says he's going to pardon Susan B. Anthony, the leader of the women's suffrage movement, who was arrested for voting in 1872 in violation of laws permitting only men to vote. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for joining us today. For in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day, you can find more information by visiting our website. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. You can do so on your phone, your tablet, or any other electronic device. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since 2017, the People's Republic of China has ramped up its persecution of Uyghurs, ethnic Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and members of other Muslim minorities in Xinjiang. It is no accident that this state follows on the heels of the 2016 installation of Politburo member Chen Jianghua as Communist Party Secretary of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. There, he also serves as the head of the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corps, or XPCC, an economic and paramilitary organization in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, which is under direct control of China's central government and fulfills numerous governmental functions in Xinjiang. Soon after his arrival in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, Chen Jianghua began implementing a comprehensive surveillance, detention, and indoctrination program there, targeting Uyghurs and members of other religious and ethnic minorities. At this time, hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs, ethnic Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and other ethnic Turkic Muslims were arrested for infractions, such as having a beard or refusing to drink alcohol, and are being held in internment camps. The United States and the Trump administration are committed to defending the human rights of oppressed people everywhere. For their connection to the egregious abuses they have heaped on the people of Xinjiang, both the United States Departments of Treasury and State have sanctioned Chen Jianghua, director of the Xinjiang Public Security Bureau, Wang Minchan, Zhu Hailun, a senior party member in Xinjiang, former security official Huo Liuzhun, former XPCC party secretary Sun Jinlong, and XPCC deputy secretary Peng Jiarui. Treasury also imposed sanctions on the PSB and XPCC themselves. Treasury sanctions pursuant to Executive Order 13818, which builds upon and implements the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act that forbids sanctioned individuals from entering the United States. These sanctions also freeze their U.S.-based assets. The United States has taken the strongest actions of any nation in the world to protect the human rights of all people in China. The Chinese Communist Party's human rights abuses in Xinjiang, China against Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities, rank as the stain of the century, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a written statement. The Trump administration has led the world's effort to impose tangible costs on the PRC's continuous campaign of repression, mass arbitrary detention, intrusive surveillance, forced labor, forced population control, involuntary collection of biometric data, and genetic analyses targeted at these groups. Today, we are continuing that record of principled action.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.